Okay, welcome back to our Voices of the Middle East show about Turkey and membership in the EU. We were talking about the process of membership discussion and what went in the past year or so, and we talked about a little bit about the kind of resentment that we are seeing in some of European countries, and I mentioned Germany. I suppose probably one reason that Angela Merkel was trying to put this as a campaign issue and try to advertise on it and propagate on that issue is the unemployment in Germany and the fear that they have they could create, saying that, okay, if there is a membership of Turkey in Union, then there would be an open door, open borders for everybody to come, and they're going to take work out of Germans, so to speak, or in other countries. I think that's one of the fears. But how do you feel that effect on job market would be? I know there are lots of Turks working in Germany right now. And how do they get the work permit now, and what would be different?
Well, new people cannot go there unless they have some family ties.
Okay.
What we have in Germany, about 4 million Turks, 4.5 million Turks, they're the children of the Geisterbeiter, the workers who went there in the late 60s and 1970s to do the remedial works that people in Germany didn't want to do. But their children now are EU citizens, and they even got elected to the parliament, and they're in the local governments and the state legislature and so forth. However, European Union, by and large, is losing economic ground. There's very large unemployment in Europe, and it's not getting better. It doesn't look good. There's a continuous economic decline. Even the best countries are basically surviving rather than expanding. When we looked at the reasons why people voted no in France for the constitution, they identified loss of jobs, and they fear that if Turkey joins the European Union, a very large country, 76, 77 million people and young population, mm-hmm. that the floodgates will open, and young Turks will be flooding over to Europe looking for jobs, creating even more of a problem. Well, a couple of things about that. One, that can be restricted. Accession treaties does not simply say everything is hunky-dory, you open the doors and then you have freedom of movement. You can restrict it for a time period. Mm-hmm. You can ask for a derogation exception from law. And that, I suspect, is going to be included in any accession treaty the EU signs with Turkey, that for X period of time, there will be no free movement of labor. Mm-hmm. By that time, I have no idea what Turkey will look like. Given its economic boom in recent years, it may be one of the places where jobs are created even more by European investments. And we may even see influx of labor from other countries. The EU member states are facing an added problem because they just added 10 countries that are generally poor. Mm-hmm. And they're losing jobs because of investments in those countries as well. So this latest growth has been a negative impact on the ordinary workers in the established old countries of the European Union. Just consider this. If Turkey joins the EU in 10 years, it will have population roughly the size of Germany. And then, by the mid-century, Turkey will have the largest population in the EU, and Turks will make up about 18% of the EU population. So it's in everybody's interest to limit, restrict free movement of labor. Mm-hmm. And when Turkey joins the European Union. But right now, when you look at it, it's a big fear. that it looks like an impossible task for European Union to handle. The former Commissioner for Enlargement, Günther Verhugen, once said, including Turkey in the EU is not even comparable for the recent enlargement that included 10 countries, because Turkey is like a continent. It's huge, and it's very complex. And its economy is quite challenging until it becomes quite stable and has stable growth rate, inflation rate, and so forth. I really don't see membership in the horizon. This will be a while.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, let me just share with you one study we did at the Hatfield School. We looked at the future scenarios of different enlargements for the EU. Right now, 25 countries. That continues as is, or it becomes 27, 29, or 31. And these scenarios, starting with the 29, 30, 31, it includes Turkey as of year 2015, 2020. And using economic growth formulas, we estimated per capita productivity in the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
We also looked at the share the EU will have of the global gross domestic product of the entire world economy. And it continues to decline. It loses ground against China, India, United States. U.S. is declining. By year 2025, China will have the same size economy as the United States. And in the years further down the road, China will become the number one economy in the world. Everybody now realizes that. United States will continue having the largest per capita productivity, but because of the differences in population, China will be ahead. India catches up and passes the U.S. same way by mid-century. European Union continues declining. At best, it maintains its current level of per capita productivity until Turkey is added into the Union. Then as of 2030, 2035, it starts picking up. It levels off and starts growing in terms of having a larger share of the world economy. And then when we include Ukraine, it gets even a little faster. Now, some of the European technocrats are aware of this. A year ago, when the European Commission in Brussels issued its final report on Turkey, saying, is Turkey ready or not for accession talks, instead of simply writing a review, they also published another document. And that document was titled Benefits and Challenges of Having Turkey in the European Union. And the benefits outweighed the challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaders in December last year decided, okay, Turkey has met certain conditions that we set. Now we can start accession talks and see if we can end in a membership down the road.
We're talking most about really the economic impact. I'm sure some of the concerns of, again, some of the European political figures, or at least the way they are talking about it, is that the security issues and the fact that by Turkey joining EU, actually Europe is going to be a neighbor with hot spots in the Middle East, and whether they're going to have any hole in the wall to get in. Is there any concern in that regard? Would be that, like, the, I don't know really how travel will impact by membership of Turkey into European Union?
Yeah, absolutely there is fear of that, because it is a hot spot, and who knows what's going to happen in Iraq down the road. When the United States decides to come home, will Iraq remain a united country, or will it blow up and we have civil war, and God knows what's going to happen after that?
Mm-hmm.
It's probable. During the accession talks with Turkey, Turkey's customs and border controls will all have to change to become at comparable at EU standards. So this is another one of those changes that are required. And, of course, these are huge borders, very long borders and porous borders. it's impossible to control the border between Turkey and Syria and Turkey and Iran and Iraq. It's mountainous and very difficult to control. There's always that problem. And right now we are seeing transit of people through Turkey into Europe. It's also happening from the south as well, through the Mediterranean into Europe. And Europeans are realizing that there is no way in the world they're going to be able to stop transit and trafficking of people across their borders. So they're emphasizing economic development in these countries to help them keep their job-seeking populations.
Okay, one kind of last issue that I want to talk. We're getting close to the end of the portion we have for this topic. The impact of membership in EU on Turkey, as opposed to the way around, and specifically about the social issues and human rights issues. You mentioned in your opening statement talking about the ethnicities in Turkey, the Kurds, the Armenians. I know there was a conference a couple of weeks ago, was supposed to happen either in Ankara or Istanbul, I'm not sure where, about the Armenians. And it was canceled a couple times, finally got to the court, but finally, I guess it opened. Do you see any impact of how Turkish government would operate or would try to liberalize some of the issues that is now in the eyes of the European countries?
Yes.
In the light of this application
yes.
process?
Absolutely. This is the first government that I can recall that has identified that Turkey has problems. Mm-hmm. And Prime Minister referred to Kurdish issues as a Kurdish problem, that there is a problem in the country. Otherwise, how do you explain the insurgency of the PKK?
Right.
It's operating out of northern Iraq, and it has restarted a military campaign. The conference you mentioned about the Armenian issue,
right.
What is it? Is it genocide? Is it mass murder? Is it forced expulsion? Scholars had very difficult time getting together. First, there was a minister who tried to label them. He was silenced by the cabinet. Then the prosecutor, basically said, no, this cannot be held. He took it to the court and put a hold on it.
Right.
Because these are state universities. But they changed the venue. The government said it should take place, but the judiciary is now independent.
Right.
So this is an example of implementation of the laws that have changed.
Mm-hmm.
If you have people in the bureaucracy and in the judiciary who pretend as if these changes haven't taken place, they're going to use their powers to try to block it. Eventually, they couldn't. And there will be another conference next year at Istanbul University that's going to be even bigger. You know, the genie is out of the bottle. People are discussing these issues, and the press is freely discussing it. A good example of this misinterpretation of the laws that have changed is the case of Orhan Pamuk, who's been charged by a prosecutor for insulting, quote-unquote, insulting the state. Well, they're going to be back in session in December, I believe, the judiciary, and it's going to be rather interesting to see him go in front of the judge to defend himself. And interestingly enough, previously another prosecutor tried to charge him with it, and the court said, this is ridiculous. There is no charge.
Mm-hmm.
So another prosecutor went after him. This author is the most famous author of contemporary Turkish writers right now.
Yeah.
And one day I wouldn't be surprised if he gets the Nobel Prize in Literature. So you see, laws change in the last 3 years, but implementation is yet another issue. So the EU process is forcing the structure to change and the minds gradually.
Right.
This doesn't happen overnight. But I see a lot of opening. And this wouldn't have happened in Turkey without the EU process.
And we are in the week of, I guess, international campaign against the capital punishment. And Turkey also kind of halted any executions in the past, I think, 3-4 years.
It's eliminated.
Eliminated.
It's gone.
Totally out of the
As of 2 years ago. It's not in the books.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Yoshida, for coming to this program. And I got your promise to be back with Dr.
Harry.
Anastasio.
Well, pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much.
It was delightful. And I promise you, we'll be back with Harry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night. Welcome back to Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM. They're about 6:45, and we're going to switch from Turkey to further south to either Kurdistan in Iraq or Iraqi Kurdistan or Turkish Kurdistan. Where are we?
Iraqi Kurdistan.
Turn it
there. Hey. It's Iraqi Kurdistan, actually.
Okay, great. I have with me Anne Casper, a very good friend, a longtime friend and activist in Portland. She's also very active in Kurdish immigrant community in town. And actually, there was no conspiracy to go from Turkey to Kurdish issue, but I think Farouk, who has been here, have a very probably a nice story to tell us. And I would like Anne to first introduce Farouk in the whole situation that brought you here tonight and share with our audience this, I guess, sensational development in the problem you guys had.
Thank you, Gudars. Actually, last January, Farouk Ghadi, who's been here for how many years now in Portland, Oregon?
It's about 9 years.
9 years here. Came and talked to me and told me about his brother who needed spinal surgery. Mm-hmm. And that spinal surgery is now not offered in Iraq. There's just no way to get it. And we had discussed how we could do this, and we started the different steps. And first we had called several agencies, and it was they thought it might be a very difficult situation to help out, and so we started to do it on our own. And by that, we started to look at what we would need to do. And Farouk had actually, last year, talked to Providence, St. Vincent's Hospital. Could you talk about how you found the doctor there?
Actually, I have contacted a friend in, actually, he's a doctor. His name, Dr. Ali Khaki, is originally from Iraq. And I asked him to, I asked him for help, and he have found another doctor, another specialist doctor for my brother's case. His name, Dr. Ali, I'm sorry, Dr. Todd Keither. And I went to, I found him and I went to him, and he reviewed all the medical chart and MRIs, and he gave me a detailed report about his situation, and he said it's possible to get this kind of to make this kind of surgery here, and also he said I'm willing to do it, which is was very nice thing from him. It was a unique thing from him. And then after that, and Casper started to contact the hospital again about other issues, so she could continue.
I'm sure that that kind of operation and surgery is pretty expensive, and you had the transport, Farhad
yes,
Muhammad,
Farhad.
Your brother.
Yes.
Yeah, you had to transport him here, and so how did you come up with the funding to do that?
Actually, the hospital is helping us out with the medical issues, and the transportation is handled actually by Farouk's family.
Okay.
So that's it's really a private situation with the funding. We had a bit of a problem getting visas to come here. The first visa we tried for was denied, actually, and it took that was we got help from Senator Smith's office, which was very nice of them to do that. And then we tried for a second visa through Darlene Hooley's office and was able to get it, which is a medical temporary visa here.
So he is here now?
Yeah,
yes.
He's here. And I would like to mention that KHRW, Kurdish Human Rights Watch office, they helped me in the end to process the visa at the U.S. Embassy. So everyone hand-to-hand helped to bring my brother here and have done the surgery for him just last Monday. He's still at the hospital. And he feel very good because the surgery was very successful, and everyone very happy about it.
Great. What was the cause of? Did he have an accident or this was just a?
No, it's no accident. Actually, it was just degenerative, and it's happening over many years in his body.
Okay.
And he's basically paralyzed on one side. So the spinal surgery will bring back the nerve endings and work on one side of his body.
Okay, great. And then when he goes back, is there possibilities there to be treated or to be taken care of? Or
Actually, he's been suffering from this problem since the last 10 years. And the problem developed gradually until he ended to get like half paralyzed. But what the doctors saying that after they remove the pressure on his spine cord, he will gradually get better, and he will not end of a wheelchair. And after making some physical therapies, he will be good. He will be well.
Great. I guess we should thank St. Vincent Hospitals and doctors there for doing that. And we kind of Anne suggested that we might have been able to talk to hospital officials on this issue, but unfortunately tonight I don't have any extra time to do the phone call, but we just send our prayers to our friend Farhad Muhammad and wish him the best of health, and wish both of you success in continuing what you're doing with your brother, and hopefully he'll be released soon.
Could I mention, too,
sure.
If people are interested, they can look at a website. It's kurdkarma.com, and we'll have updates on Farhad on that.
So the website was Kurd Karma. Can you spell that?
K-U-R-D-K-A-R-M-A.com.
Okay, Kurd Karma. And that's the website for Ann Casper, and there would be updated information about Farhad Muhammad, who came here to go through an operation and surgery. Thank you very much both for coming tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.